The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here,
reminding you that American Family Insurance agents can help build a customized renter's policy so you can protect stuff like this, or this, or even this. Case in point. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. You're driving on a back road on a Sunday afternoon with your spouse. It's something you do often just to get out and enjoy nature and take a leisurely drive. As you travel along with the road to yourselves, suddenly a large van appears behind you. At first, you don't think anything of it. It's simply someone else traveling beside you. But then the van speeds up and you realize how fast it's actually going. Before you know it, it's riding your bumper and then filling your rearview mirror. Then the van suddenly swerves around you in order to pass, and you're startled at how recklessly the man behind the wheel is driving. He passes you and flies up ahead on the desolate country road. But before long, you come upon that same van, and this time it's parked off to the side of the road. Through the trees, you see the man struggling to get something out of the back of the vehicle. You realize you're witnessing something sinister, something that could get you killed. If this little snippet of a story sounds familiar to you, that's because you have most likely seen it in the film Jeepers Creepers. Only in the film, it's not a van, it's a modified tank-like vehicle, and it's not a man, it's a monster. You'll find out today that the film and the real story might have different vehicles in them, but both versions do, in fact, have a monster. This is the story of the murder of Marilyn Depew and the year-long chase to capture her husband, Dennis Depew. The story that inspired the horror film Jeepers Creepers. Let's get into it. This is Dennis Depew. He was born on June 13, 1943, in Sturgis, Michigan, to Claude and Elma Depew. He went to Burke Oak High School in Goldwater and then got a bachelor's degree in business from Michigan State University. Dennis worked for the state of Michigan for more than 20 years as a property tax specialist. In his 20s, he married this woman, Marilyn McClenahan, who was born in 1941 in Detroit to Dallas and Betty McClenahan. After Dennis and Marilyn were married, they made their home in Michigan. Dennis spent a lot of time at work as a property assessor, and Marilyn worked as a school counselor, where she was loved and adored. The couple had three children together. Though there is differing information online, I believe the Depew children's names to be Jennifer, Julie, and Scott. We know for sure that the oldest daughter's name was Jennifer. They were all teenagers by 1990. To the outside world, everything appeared normal inside the Depew household, but it was not. Dennis was a very distant and cold man, and as he aged, those qualities intensified. By the mid-1980s, Marilyn was very unhappy in the marriage, and she wanted out, but every time she talked seriously of leaving Dennis, he would convince her that he was going to change and she would stay. Ann Dunkel, one of Marilyn's co-workers, later shared some of the things Marilyn told her. Marilyn said that there was no love between she and Dennis anymore. She said she didn't even feel like she was breaking up a marriage at that point because the marriage had simply dissolved. Marilyn said she and Dennis rarely even spoke at times. There was no friendship, there was no partnership, there was no intimacy. Marilyn was dreadfully lonely and unhappy, and she didn't care who knew it. From the mid-80s to the late 80s, nothing changed, and Marilyn told her friends and coworkers she was getting more fed up all the time. As is no surprise, Dennis had a different story. He told one of his coworkers, this man, C. Jan Markowski, that Marilyn had turned the children against him. Dennis said that she constantly complained about how unhappy she was and about the fact that she wanted a divorce. And Dennis felt like all of Marilyn's unhappiness and complaining had made his own children hate him. Now, what was actually going on in the house, no one will ever know. Just like no one will ever know what goes on between me and my partner and you and yours. Both people have sides to every issue, but only the two people involved in the relationship really know the nuances and the truth. And even for them, the truth might be skewed because people get blinded by their perception and might not really see what's going on. Suffice it to say, Dennis and Marilyn Depew were living a very unhappy and unfulfilled life. People would later say that as they drove by the Depew house, they'd see the boys playing football in the yard. The kids did well in school and they didn't get into trouble. But we all know those are just surface things. In many homes, the sadness and the despair is there, but it's just under the surface, under what most of us see. And that's what was happening in the Depew household. By 1989, Marilyn had had enough. She had waited and hoped and argued for years, and nothing was changing in the marriage or in the home, and she gathered the courage to go and file for divorce. Her attorney told her that Dennis wasn't going to go down without a fight, and he didn't. They fought over the children and they fought over the house. In the end, Marilyn ended up staying in the house with most of the custody rights over the children. Dennis moved out and got visitation, but there was a problem. He didn't stay out. Marilyn had the locks on the house changed because she was not only finished with Dennis, she was afraid of him. Despite having the locks changed, it was not uncommon for Marilyn to come home to find Dennis sitting on the couch in the living room. She never had any idea how he got in, but each time there was a fight, and each time she would call the locksmith again and spend money to have all of the locks changed. A few weeks would go by without incident, and then again she'd walk into her house to see her ex-husband waiting for her. Now, of course, we see this as very dangerous stalking behavior. We've learned so much since then. We still have a ways to go. We know now that when a partner will not let another person go, it's a red flag. It's dangerous and bad things happen. Back in the 1980s, I mean, I was just a kid, but I would assume the attitude was kind of one of, well, you know, she's lucky she got to stay in the house. Who cares if he goes in there once in a while? He paid for a lot of that house. You see what I mean? Attitudes were different back then, and I think there are still people that have those attitudes, but I remember hearing conversations like this when I was a teenager, and I knew people that went through similar things like this. Though we now see, from the lens of the future, Dennis's behavior as incredibly dangerous and foreboding of more violence to come, back then it was just difficult for a woman to get help with a stalker, especially one that she'd been in a relationship with. I think it's still difficult. It was also very difficult for Marilyn to get her children to abide by the visitation agreement set forth by the courts. The kids didn't want visitation with Dennis, and they were old enough to say what they wanted and what they didn't. Like I said earlier, Dennis told his friends and family that Marilyn had turned the children against him, and he was very, very angry about that. We will never know if Marilyn worked to influence her kids or not, but I will tell you, it's tough to get a teenager to do something they don't want to do, and if they didn't want to go with their father, that, to me, is telling. To me, it says they really didn't want to be with him. Often, when Dennis would come to pick the kids up and take them for his weekend of custody, the kids cried and complained and really made a fuss about not wanting to go and spend time with their dad. And I'm sure that was difficult for Dennis, and I'm sure it was difficult for Marilyn, but it was undoubtedly most difficult for the children. Each time their father came for them, it was a battle, until one day, the battle turned into a war. April 15th, 1990. It was Easter Sunday in 1990, and Dennis Perdue had plans to spend the day with his children. He drove his 1980-style brown and tan van to his former home, the home where his wife and children still lived, and he went inside. I have to mention, I found articles that claimed the vehicle was a green 1984 Chevrolet pickup truck, but I saw actual witness testimony stating it was a brown and tan passenger van, so I'm going with the eyewitnesses. On this day, when Dennis entered the house to take the kids, his youngest son was at the kitchen table playing a video game, and when his father told him it was time to go, the boy flat out refused. He told his father he wasn't going with him, and that was that. So Dennis became angry and grabbed his son around the back of the neck, forcing him to stand up from the table. As he did so, Julie and Jennifer came running down the hall, and an argument ensued. Then Marilyn got involved. She shouted at Dennis that he was hurting their son and to let him go, but this only further enraged Dennis. He grabbed his wife by the arm and tried to force her downstairs with him. She tripped and fell, tumbling down the stairs to the basement. Dennis stormed down the stairs after her, and now, with the children standing at the top of the stairs, shouting and crying, he forced his ex-wife to her feet. Her face was bleeding and she was dazed from the fall. Dennis dragged his ex-wife up the stairs, and Julie Depew recalls that as her father pulled her mother past him, her mother looked at her very confused, and Julie realized that her mother was not completely conscious. Dennis continued to struggle with Marilyn, and Julie ran out the front door to a neighbor's house to use their phone to call the police. While she was gone, Dennis dragged Marilyn to his van and put her inside. He left the other kids in the house and drove away with their mother inside, and they didn't have any idea at the time they would never see her again. On that same day, Ray and Marie Thornton were out for a Sunday drive. This was something they would do quite often, go to the outskirts of Coldwater and drive on the backcountry roads. Ray and Marie were a happy couple, and because they both liked to take long drives, they'd made up a game. Every time they saw another car, they'd take the letters on the license plate and see how many words they could make with those letters. As they leisurely drove along, very quickly, a brown and tan van appeared behind them, and it was coming up on them fast. Soon the van was right in their rearview mirror, and then it swerved and passed the Thorntons very quickly. Marie looked at the license plate, which had the letters GZ on it, and, still playing the word game, said, "Geez, he must be in a hurry." The van sped past them, and the Thorntons continued on their little amble through the Michigan countryside. A few minutes later, they came upon this abandoned schoolhouse. It had crumbling corners and broken windows, some were boarded up, and with the wind whistling through the missing doors and shattered glass, the schoolhouse was a bit of a spooky place to wander around. It was a building the Thorntons had passed many times, but today something was different. As they drew closer to the abandoned schoolyard, through the trees and towards the back of the building, they could see the brown and tan van that had passed them at a high rate of speed back a few miles. It was parked between the schoolhouse and this large rusty tank. Ray slowed the car a bit to make sure everything was okay. The van was empty, and then they saw where the driver was. Just past the van and further into the trees was a man. He was struggling with something heavy, and then Ray and Marie saw a flash of white. It was a white blanket or bedsheet, and it was covered with blood. Marie was nervous, and she said to Ray, "He's done something, hasn't he?" And Ray replied, "Yes, he has." So Ray continued driving, but he could feel his heart pounding. Marie was nervous, but so was he. They had seen something they shouldn't have seen. Ray's heart sunk as he looked in the rearview mirror and saw, again, the van coming up behind them very fast. He continued driving as the van pulled up and began riding their bumper. Ray and Marie tried to stay calm. Remember, they had no cell phone back then, no way to call for help, and there they were, alone on a very desolate stretch of country road. The van followed them for a mile and then for two, and both Ray and Marie became more and more frightened about what the driver was planning to do. That driver knew that Ray and Marie had seen him behind the schoolhouse, but perhaps he was wondering just exactly what they had seen. Was it enough to kill two people over? Suddenly, the van swerved around the Thornton sedan and got right in front of them. Both vehicles were still traveling south. Ray then decided to turn off the highway. He pulled off on the first side road that he came to, and when he pulled over, the van pulled over to the opposite side of the road and sat there idling. The driver did not get out, and so Ray just kept driving down the side road. He and Marie talked, wondering if the van was going to begin chasing them again, but it didn't. Soon the van pulled away, and that's when Ray decided he had to go and investigate. Ray Thornton flipped his car around and drove back down the side road he'd traveled up. He turned back onto the main country road and less than a minute later was shocked to see the van pulled over up ahead of him on the side of the road. The driver was out of the vehicle, kneeling down towards the back of the van. That's when Ray and Marie realized the man was removing his license plate. Marie believed she saw a second plate on the ground that the man was going to put on the vehicle after he removed the plate that Ray and Marie had seen. As the Thorntons drove past the van, they saw that the passenger door was flung wide open, and they gasped as they realized it was absolutely covered in blood. Now, had I been the Thorntons, I would have been out of there so fast. With no way to call for help, knowing there's this man driving like a lunatic, changing out the license plates on his vehicle with the interior of his van covered in blood. Yeah, I've seen enough horror movies to know it's time to hit the bricks and go straight to the police. But that isn't what the Thorntons did. To their credit, they saw something and they did something. Ray turned the car around and went back to the abandoned schoolhouse to see if they could find anything. Ray pulled their car over to the side of the road, and with the late afternoon wind whistling through shattered windows and whipping the tall reeds, Ray and Marie took each other by the hand and approached the building. Towards the rear side entrance, they saw what they believed they had seen earlier, a white sheet covered in blood. There was no doubt at that point. Something very sinister had happened on this country road that day. Back at the Depew home, Julie had informed the neighbors of what happened, that their father had come to the house and after kind of forcing their mother to fall down the stairs, he had dragged her off. At some point in the confrontation, Dennis had told the kids that he was going to take Marilyn to the hospital. Well, of course, they never arrived at a hospital. So within the hour, the police began searching for Dennis's vehicle. They brought in a helicopter to search from the air, and the police put out a BOLO, a be on the lookout alert, so all patrol officers would be watching for this van. Not long after the search began, the Thorntons arrived at a payphone and called the police. Because the Thorntons had such a detailed description of the van, the police knew it was Dennis Depew they had seen on the road, and they immediately sent police to the abandoned schoolhouse. Here you can see the investigation underway. Cops found tire tracks and made plaster casts of them in order to match them up with Dennis Depew's tire at a later date, hopefully when they found the van. They also found a pool of blood. Marilyn Depew's body was not at the abandoned schoolhouse. I personally believe that Dennis was planning to dump Marilyn at the school, but because the Thorntons had seen him, he didn't. So now the police knew Dennis Depew was missing and Marilyn Depew was as well. She was either gravely injured or more likely dead, but they didn't have a body yet. April 16th, 1990. The day after Easter Sunday, after the fight at the Depew house and the Thorntons witnessing all that they did, a highway worker noticed something in the tall grass and bushes along the old country road. As he approached, he saw her. There was Marilyn Depew. She had been shot in the back of the head and dumped like garbage on the side of the road. They had found Marilyn, but now Dennis was nowhere in sight. Several days passed, and then the police began receiving phone calls from Dennis Depew's friends and relatives. The people calling said they had each received a letter from Dennis. Each one of these letters that came in the mail were different, but basically said much of the same thing. Dennis was angry. He had lost everything. His kids had turned against him. He had no reason to live. In the letter Dennis sent to his friend, Jan Markowski, Dennis accused Marilyn of lying to him, of tricking him, and of dragging out the divorce. Of course, Dennis never took any accountability for his part in the marriage disintegrating. People like this tend to always blame others, but fail to look inward and accept their part. Each of these letters sent by Dennis was postmarked not only from a different city, but from a different state. Some were postmarked in Oklahoma. One was in Virginia. Some in Iowa. All in all, Dennis had sent 17 letters to his friends, coworkers, and family members. Dennis even went so far as to blame some of Marilyn's friends and coworkers for her death. Again, never taking any responsibility for his part in the divorce, let alone taking responsibility for pulling the trigger and killing Marilyn. It's always somebody else's fault, right? Always. Weeks went by and then months, and police could not find Dennis DePue. They'd exhausted all their resources and had followed every clue that came in, but they could not seem to get a lead on him. And then, in March of 1991, the TV show Unsolved Mysteries decided to air a segment on the murder. On the night of the broadcast, this woman, who wants to be known only as Mary, pulled into her garage and saw that her boyfriend, Hank Quinn's brown and tan van, was parked in the driveway. This was unusual, as the van was usually inside the garage. Mary saw that Hank's van looked like it was packed with some of his belongings. She went inside the house, and there was her boyfriend, Hank, telling her that his mother was critically ill and he had to leave immediately to go and take care of her. Mary noticed that Hank was sweating and nervous, and she also noticed that the TV was on in the living room, and Hank's chair and dinner were pulled up next to it as if he had just been watching the show before she walked in. The show on the TV? Unsolved Mysteries. Later on, Mary would say that she felt Hank was going out of his way to pull her away from the television and keep her distracted. He started asking her to make him some sandwiches to take on the long road to his mother's, and he kind of hustled Mary into the kitchen to begin preparing the food. As Mary stood in the kitchen making those sandwiches, Hank, as she knew him, was in the bedroom stuffing some personal clothing and other items into a suitcase. Hank threw everything into the van, Mary asked for a kiss and a hug, and she said that as Hank drove out of her driveway, she knew she would never see him again. Just hours later, Mary would learn that her live-in boyfriend, Hank Quinn, was actually Dennis DePue, and he was wanted for murder. Not only that, he had been featured on national television that night. One of Mary's neighbors, who knew Hank and who was also really good with numbers and had a habit of memorizing license plates, called the police and told them where Hank/Dennis was living and what the numbers were on the license plate he was using at the time. Like, how lucky is that? How often do the police have somebody with that kind of a memory that looks at people's license plates? About 4 hours after the police were alerted to Dennis's last residence, some patrol officers spotted his van driving in Louisiana. They flipped on their lights, but Dennis DePue refused to pull over. Not only did he not pull over, but he sped down the freeway and led the officers on a 15-mile chase. The officers were given the authority to shoot out the tires on Dennis's van, and they did just that. Even that didn't stop Dennis. He continued driving on the bare rims for about a half a mile, and then he stopped the van and finally pulled over. Dennis then pulled out a gun and fired 2 shots through the windshield at the police. They believe in an attempt to commit suicide by cop. For some reason, the police did not fire back. Dennis then fired another shot through the open window. The police still did not fire back, which is a detail that I find confusing and incredible. That is not really the usual outcome. But again, this was 30 years ago. Perhaps procedures were different back then. With Dennis sitting there in the van, trapped with no tires and nowhere to go, he pulled out his weapon and ended his own life. This coward of a man not only took his own children's mother from them, but he ran away, started a new life, and when he got caught, made sure no one involved would ever feel an ounce of closure or justice for the terrible crimes he committed. He was truly spineless. I found this raw news package. It doesn't even have the field reporter's voiceover included, but I want to share it with you because it's such a great snapshot of this moment in time.
I saw the program, and when I saw the van and looked at him, at that time I recognized him as being the man that they showed the photograph on the program last night.
For those of you who have seen the film Jeepers Creepers, I'm sure you're picturing in your mind the opening scene of that film as I told the story about the Thorntons driving along the country road. In the film, it's a brother and a sister that are headed home to see their mother for spring break. They take a shortcut, which is always the surest way in a horror film to get murdered, and they find themselves on a desolate back road. as they drive, this kind of tank-looking modified old pickup truck comes up very quickly behind them and tries to run them off the road. As that truck passes, they continue on, but then come upon that truck again, and they see this very strange-looking driver who turns out to be this guy. One of the truly great horror movie monsters. He's throwing what looks like a wrapped body down a well. Of course, the brother insists on turning back to see if they can help the person who has been dumped. He ends up falling down the well, and very scary stuff proceeds from then. His sister rescues him from the well, but at that time, it's too late. The creature has their scent, and he is not going to let them get away. I've probably seen Jeepers Creepers 5 or 6 times. It's a good film. The sequels, the second one is pretty good, but everything after that is disappointing. Now, when I first saw the original, I had no idea that the beginning of the film, kind of the entire plot, was based on a true story. Why would anyone ever think that? It's a creature, kind of a beast, that's doing the killing. So that can't be real, right? But then when I sat and I thought about it, of course it's real. No, Dennis DePew doesn't look like this guy does, but none of the men who commit these terrible crimes look like this guy does. That doesn't mean they aren't monsters. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. If you want to support me, please subscribe to my channel, hit the like button on my videos, and if you really want to help out, you can join my Patreon. The end goal there is to raise money to have cold case DNA tested. There are a lot of sexual assault kits that have DNA in them in storage that have never been tested because there's no money to test them. It's really important to get these kits tested because it gets the perpetrator's DNA in the system. Of course, it's about solving that crime, that sexual assault, that break-in, whatever it was. But just as importantly, it's about getting that perpetrator's DNA in the system. So the ultimate goal on Patreon is to raise enough money to be able to donate. If you can donate a couple bucks a month, that helps. I sure appreciate you being here. Your support is the reason I do this, and it's the reason that I truly believe we're going to make change. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and 2 rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.